Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
I'm particularly excited to be here because some of the work that was done for this story was done by very important scientists that have now traveled from UCLA to UC San Diego to continue their scientific journey. So I'll be speaking about the restoration of T cell development in CD3 delta SCID through adenine-based editing. And I hope to impart upon you not only some exciting science, but also how important collaboration was in this work. And I think it will be pretty evident that if any of these pieces were missing, we would not have found the success that we did. So my background is in T cell biology, and more recently I've become interested in understanding how T cells develop in a variety of different settings. And so as we know, they originate from HSPCs that live in our bone marrow, and they traffic to your thymus, which is a butterfly-shaped organ that sits on top of your heart. And it's in this organ that they undergo education. So for the trainees in our audience, they have to go through different titles, pass different tests, defense, maybe even boards, and then they're able to exit into the periphery and populate our blood and our tissue. So in this condition, CD3 delta SCID, there's a fundamental defect in the ability to undergo thymopoiesis. So as someone who's interested in T cell development, this becomes a particularly interesting challenge. And it's also an opportunity to understand some of the mechanics of T cell development. So CD3 delta SCID is caused by a homozygous mutation in the gene CD3D, and this leads to an inborn error of immunity. And if we zoom in on the exact mutation, it is a single base pair substitution, where there is a T in the place of a C at the 202 location of the gene. And unfortunately, this leads to a premature stop codon. And this results in the inability to even translate the CD3 delta protein. And so we know that in the absence of this protein, in fact, the CD3 TCR complex cannot be expressed on the cell surface. And this turns out to be a really critical part of T cell development. So unfortunately, these patients do not have any T cells, and they die from infections at a relatively high rate during infancy. So CD3 delta SCID exists all throughout the world, but in geographical clusters. And that's due to a quasi-founder effect. So in Northern America, the predominant community that houses this mutation is the Mennonite community, which is a religious and social community with some relative isolation from society, also lack of healthcare access and healthcare literacy. So while it is a very rare form of SCID in Alberta, Canada, it actually accounts for over 20% of the SCIDs that are seen there. And we would hypothesize that potentially even a higher prevalence, given the social challenges that this community faces. So this is an image of Dr. Nicola Wright, who's a pediatric hematologist in Calgary. And she really was the genesis of this story. She was at a conference, not dissimilar to the one that we're here today, and she heard Donald Cohn give us a talk, and she approached him after his talk and asked if he'd be willing to develop a gene therapy for her patients, and he said yes. So what is the current treatment for this disease? It's an allo stem cell transplant, and so as many of us in this room know, that comes with some risks. And challenges, finding a matched donor, the risk of GVHD, the toxic conditioning regimens, especially for these young population. So our proposed approach is to design a gene therapy at the stem cell level and to use that as a substrate for an auto transplant. So this abrogates the need for a matched donor. It also will not lead to GVHD, and the conditioning regimen is significantly reduced. So to understand why this particular mutation is so amenable to adenine-based editing, we have to look closely at its DNA. So on the left-hand side of the screen is the mutation that I mentioned, the C202T mutation, which inappropriately encodes for a premature stop codon. And in the center of the screen is a diagram of an adenine base editor. And it might look familiar to many of us in the audience because it is based on CRISPR. There are some commonalities and also some important differences in these editing approaches. So similar to CRISPR, there's a guide RNA that will bring the editor to your site of interest. But in contrast to CRISPR, it uses a Cas9 nickase that has been engineered to nick the strand as opposed to cut the strand. David Liu, who described base editing in 2016, has a really lovely analogy that I think is very adept, which is that CRISPR is like cutting the DNA with a pair of scissors and gluing it back together. Whereas adenine-based editing is using the end of an eraser, erasing the base pair you don't want, and then replacing it with the base pair that you do want. And so in this situation, there's also another enzymatic component, which is the adenosine deaminase. So that's pictured here in the purple. And what that will do is recognize the A and deaminate the adenine to an inosine. And then the nickase creates its nick. And this prompts the cell to try and repair this damage. And so what it'll do is it'll read the inosine as a guanine, as the template, and actually replace the T with a C. So hopefully it's relatively evident why in this particular mutation, ABE is so well suited to correct the mutation. And this is when our team assembled. It was a collaboration between Donald Cohn's lab and my mentor, Gay Crooks. And as mentioned previously, the other name you'll be hearing a lot today is Grace McCulley, who's sitting here in the audience and is currently an MSTP candidate in the Yale lab here. So the first question that Grace wanted to ask is, if I have a cell that has this mutation and I treat it or correct it with a base editor, can I restore expression of CD3? And so the system that she chose was a Jurkat T-cell line. And in the different rows or the different columns are different base editors in the red, purple, and green. And so each base editor has different efficiencies, has different windows in which it edits. And then for comparison is our gray bar, which is our CRISPR condition. So this is data that's representative of flow analysis. And hopefully what you can see is that the base editors all have very high efficiency of edits. Our CRISPR condition does correct some of the CD3 expression, but not to the same degree. So aside from having CD3 on your cell surface, we want to make sure that that protein functions. And so one way that we can assess this is through an assay called calcium flux. And it's based on the premise that when all of our T cells are just resting, there's very low levels of intracellular calcium. But upon activation, there's this massive influx of calcium that can be detected by flow cytometry. And you see a really beautiful mirroring of the restoration of calcium flux with the base edited conditions as compared to the CRISPR. So very high efficiency, but what about specificity? So we know that these base editors will perform its enzymatic function of deamination within a particular window. And so what Grace went on to do was to understand the bystander edits. So in this diagram, the box in green, or the A7, is our on-target edit, and the other colors represent our bystander edits. And here we see that all three of our base editors have very high levels of editing, and that's representative in the green bar. And the two on the right, the ABE8E, they actually have detectable levels of bystander edits, whereas the ABE max has high efficiency, but also very low detectable levels of bystander edits. And so in a sense, we got lucky because the ABE8E editors are actually much more efficient in their deaminase activity. And so our less efficient base editor happened to have high efficiency and also low bystander edits, probably due to the lesser promiscuity as compared to the ABE8E. So all of our further experiments were using the ABE max as our most relevant base editor. So the next experiment was an adoptive transfer experiment. And here we're really trying to assess for the durability of the edit and also the safety of this approach. It's not really an experiment designed to ask if we've fixed the defect, because we're starting with a healthy pool of CD34 positive cells. So regardless of how efficient the introduction of the mutation is, there will always be some pool of progenitor cells that can undergo hematopoiesis and T cell development. So in this experiment, using that healthy pool, we introduced the mutation and then base corrected that mutation and adoptively transferred it into an immunodeficient mouse. And 4 months later, 16 weeks later, we could assess for the durability of that edit. So here we're looking at the efficiency of edits that were retained in the different tissues of the mouse. So in the bone marrow, the spleen, the thymus, we still have pretty high levels of editing. And in fact, if we look into the bone marrow and the different compartments of the hematopoietic cells, we see retained editing in this situation as well, and even in repopulating stem cells. So this is really important, right? Because we're proposing this treatment as a one-time shot. Okay. So I might have foreshadowed a bit that we would design an experiment where we could really show that we fixed this defect. So over here on the left is a reminder of the problem. And on the right is a possible solution, right? You can imagine taking millions upon millions of cells from a patient with CD3 delta SCID, base correcting them and transplanting them into a mouse and look for T cells. Pretty straightforward. However, this is very difficult to do because it's a rare disease. It predominantly affects very young individuals, so it's hard to obtain that many cells to robustly perform this experiment. And this is where a technology that was developed in the Crookes lab becomes very relevant. And this is the artificial thymic organoid, or we call the ATO. It was developed by Amelie Montel-Hagen and Christopher Seat when they were in the Crookes lab. And it's a very elegant platform. You can take HSPCs from a variety of sources, so bone marrow, cord blood, even peripheral blood, in both mouse and human, and you aggregate them with a stromal cell line. And that stromal cell line provides a few critical features, which is one, the 3D conformation that we think mimics the thymic environment, and it's also expressing really high levels of Notch. And Notch is what allows for these stem cells to commit to the T cell lineage. And what's really wonderful is that in an in vitro system, the ATO can recapitulate all these very specific, well-orchestrated stages of T cell development. So just to drive the message home, why in particular is the ATO so well-suited to study this disease? And that requires us to understand a little bit about T cell development. And so as I mentioned, HSPCs traffic to the thymus, and they undergo this very well-orchestrated march. They become a double negative cell, an ISP4, a DP early, DP late, and then our single positive cells that are analogous to the CD4 and CD8 cells that are circulating in our blood. And there's this very biologically rich process that occurs called positive selection. And that's when a developing T cell engages with its antigen using its CD3 TCR. And so the ATO, as compared to other in vitro systems, really recapitulates this particular process in a way that previously was not possible. And so this means that this in vitro system can detect the mutation in this disease and therefore also detect the correction. So it becomes the only in vitro system where we can study this disease. So the experiment that we designed, we were fortunate enough to obtain a few million cells from a bone marrow biopsy of an 18-month-old boy prior to his allotransplant. And what we were able to do was to correct those stem cells, a small amount of stem cells, and create many, many ATOs. So in comparison to adoptive transfer experiments, an ATO can be generated by 100 or 1,000 stem cells. So it allows us to ask so many more questions from a very limited starting material. So these are flow analysis plots where we are simply looking for the restoration of CD3 expression on our cells. And so here we have our healthy donor ATO, The cells in the ellipses are those that are CD3 positive and TCR positive. In our unedited patient ATO, we see the disappearance of that population. So that means that our system is reading out the known defect, right? And with base editing, we have a return of that population. We then went on to show that these edited ATOs can also go on to differentiate into mature cells, so single positive AATs, double positive LATs, and also SP4s. So we are a very flow-heavy lab, and I promise you that we did a lot of other flow analyses, but I'm going to pivot to another technology that we employed called CiteSeq. And so this is a single cell platform that can ask multiple questions on one individual cell. And it's very bioinformatically heavy. And so we were lucky enough to have a talented postdoc who at that time was at the Crookes lab, Patrick Chang, who's also sitting in the audience. And he was able to make this really beautiful UMAP for us. And I think what's quite lovely and nifty about this UMAP is that it actually shows you thymopoiesis, right? In the upper left-hand corner, we start with our CD34s, then they migrate to DNs, ISP4s, DP earlys, DP lates, and then our single positive cells. And hopefully what is evident is that we have development in the unedited patient ATO to the very last stage in which CD3 and TCR is not required. And with editing, we can restore the differentiation and the maturation of these mature cells that by definition have CD3 and TCR on their surface. So this really beautifully reconfirms our flow data. And so I'm gonna put aside the CiteSeq data just for a second and talk about T cell function, right? Because we want to make sure that these T cells that are developing are going to work for these patients, right? Not just express CD3 on their surface. And so how do we look for T cell function? And in fact, a lot of the T cell function comes from the CD3 TCR complex because it engages with an antigen that's loaded onto an MHC that's presented by an antigen presenting cell. And after this interaction, we can ask, is the T cell activated? Is it producing cytokines? Are they proliferating? And do they have a diverse TCR repertoire or T cell receptor repertoire? And so in the lab, the way that we mimic this is to use a purified antibody or conjugated to a bead against CD3, so that's signal 1 of T cell activation, and CD28, which is signal 2 of T cell activation. So one of the first questions we asked is an echo of the experiments that Grace performed in her DRCAT lines, which is to ask whether we can restore calcium flux. And so you see in the blue and the green lines, this really nice pattern of intracellular calcium being restored, which is absent, right, in the gray line. We next asked, can these cells produce cytokines? So this is an intracellular cytokine stain where we're able to see that with base editing, our edited patient ATOs can produce interferon gamma and TNF-alpha. And do they proliferate? Yes. So here, this is an experiment using CFSC. It's a dye that permanently binds to the cell. And as it divides, we'll produce these really lovely generational peaks. And we see a very similar level of proliferation between our edited patient cells and our healthy donor cells. And in fact, while this proliferation and activation is occurring, these cells are also upregulating activation markers, so CD25, 4-1BB. Okay, so I told us that we would go back to our single cell sequencing, because the last piece looking at the TCR repertoire is very powerful when using a single cell platform. And the reason that is because the T cell receptor is comprised of two subunits. So there's a beta subunit and an alpha subunit. And the germline segments, the V, D, and J segments, have to be rearranged for this T cell receptor to be expressed. So in the beta segment, it's all three, V, D, and J, and the alpha, it's just V and J. And that individual pairing of a beta with an alpha creates a physical structure or a physical groove called this DDR3. And that is what we call a clinotype. And so with base editing, we're able to restore the number of unique clinotypes or a proxy for TCR repertoire. So I like to think a lot about how the T-cell receptor rearranges. And so one thing that we can do is actually ask, where does that difference in clinotype diversity come from? Is it from the beta subunit? Is it from the alpha subunit? And based on our understanding of TCR rearrangement, we know that the beta subunit rearranges much earlier than the alpha subunit. And in fact, by the ISP4 stage, your beta subunit should be rearranged completely. But that TRA rearrangement is pretty close to where the defect is, right? And so we would hypothesize that perhaps that difference in clinotype diversity comes from either the ability or inability to complete TRA rearrangement. And this is, in fact, what we saw. So here are pie charts where each wedge is representative of an individual V segment or J segment. And if we look at just the alpha subunit, the edited patient cells have a lot more wedges. But if we look at the beta subunit, there's really no difference. And so one interesting thing that you can do with CiteSeq is that Patrick was able to overlay this information back onto our UMAP. So in the left-hand side is just a reminder of the shape of these cells. And on the right-hand side, we're looking at the cells that only express TRB, so that's in orange. And then in purple are the cells that express both. So we're able to say then that base editing of this defect allows for the completion of TRA rearrangement and potentially is one of the mechanisms by which T-cell development is rescued. So this led to our publication, which was a little bit over a year ago. But like many of us have been talking about, science really doesn't end at publication, right? So how do we get this technology closer to our patients? And so we were fortunate enough to get funding to perform preclinical studies to try and get this closer to particularly Dr. Nicole Arright's patients. And this is being spearheaded by Thule Romero-Garcia. And I think the other really wonderful thing is that Grace was able to design base editors to the other variants internationally. And I think for a lot of people who are interested in gene editing, you know, this is a topic that's important, which is our ability to equitably distribute this technology. So I'm an adult rheumatologist, and so this work has been very inspirational to me. The ability or the interest in using gene editing in rheumatic applications is really just beginning. I think in the last year, there have been a dozen trials looking at CAR T therapies and autoimmune diseases. There have also been a few select studies looking at monogenic autoimmune conditions where editing was utilized. And so to try and capture these patients, we've established at UCLA a interdisciplinary clinic across pediatric rheumatology, allergy immunology, and adult rheumatology to try and, first of all, provide interdisciplinary care for these patients who oftentimes live on the boundaries of medical knowledge, and to also try and capture whether we can identify variants that are amenable to gene editing. And another future direction is to use some of these techniques, so ATOs, gene editing, to try and push the development of regulatory T cells that could down the line be used as a cellular therapy through dynamically expressing FOXP3, which is the transcription factor for Tregs. So I'd like to thank everyone who contributed to this study, especially Grace McCauley and Patrick Chang, who are sitting here in the audience, and of course, Don Cohn and my mentor, Gay Crooks. Love to take any questions.
My question is about the base editor, NRHT.
NRHT.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is the mechanism by which it give you a specific base editing, because you don't have bystanders there, right?
So there were a few bystanders. You just couldn't see them on the graph because of the axes. But the particular denotation after the base editor are the substitutions that can be made. So it's a code in which N is any of the nucleotides, R is A and G, T is T, and A, I think, is H, C, and T. So it's a way that the base editors were engineered. And that's why it's really important to test different base editors for a particular mutation, right? Because the surrounding nucleotides could provide a window for editing that needs to be compatible with the base editor that you choose.
Okay, thank you.
So maybe you can chime in. You've done this all from the bone marrow HSCs, right? And what
Correct.
You talked about, then the interest of doing this from IPS, right? So how that compares, and can you get the same sort of process and such through the IPS system?
Sure, yeah. So the IPS system in many ways is very translatable, right? Because it can create a potentially off-the-shelf system. And I alluded to it a little bit at the end of my talk, which is that we're trying to use that system to potentially generate Tregs. In this situation, we're proposing an auto transplant. Using the bone marrow ATO system to understand the development is sufficient. But I think your point is very well taken that, a lot of these cell therapies are hindered by cost, by availability, by matched donors. And so, having a road towards an off-the-shelf therapy, I think, is something that everyone is very interested in.
Thank you for your talk, and I am wondering if you have done genome sequencing to see off-target effects of the edited lines, like if they can introduce some mutations,
you don't want. We absolutely, very important question, we absolutely did that. I didn't have time to include it in our talk, or this talk today, but in fact, Grace did three different, I think, in silico methods to look for off-target effects, and also in vitro. And what she was able to show is that even with these bystander effects, it did not impact the ability to rescue CD3 expression. But a critical question, I think, for any gene editing, right, we want to make sure that we're not introducing something that's per-oncogenic or some chromosomal instability. And I didn't show it today either, but our base editor really seems to have a much more favorable safety profile as compared to traditional CRISPR, likely because it's not causing that double-stranded break.